Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we've seen the GOP version of the health reform bill, and it's generated quite a bit, shall we say, concern from a number of sectors. American Healthcare Act goes a long way to reduce benefits for millions of Americans, eliminates the Medicaid expansion, and reduces the essential benefits required to be covered by the insurance industry.
And as you might imagine, Mark, there are differing views on how viable this proposed replacement to Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act really is. An estimated 15 million Americans would lose coverage and costs would increase for many consumers. That analysis is corroborated by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office.
States with large Medicaid populations would be especially hard hit. Ohio alone stands to lose from $16 billion to $26 billion over the next several years if the Medicaid expansion goes away.
Another concerning provision of the GOP plan, Mark, would eliminate requirements for insurance companies to cover mental health and addiction services, something that has taken so long to get in place. This, of course, has many health professionals deeply worried about their capacity to continue to confront this still somewhat unmet need, especially in light of the deadly opioid crisis, something that affects every state, every county in the country, with drug overdose deaths reaching 50,000 in 2015 alone. This is just a national tragedy that knows no boundaries, affects families across all geographic and socioeconomic sectors and political sectors as well. So we thought we would revisit our conversation with Paul Gianfrido, president of Mental Health America, which seeks to advance parity, coverage, and treatment for all diseases of the brain, including addiction. He's a passionate advocate at a time when we really need to have this conversation.
Indeed, Margaret. Laurie Robertson also stops by. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Paul Gianfrido in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The report by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office on the potential impact of the American Healthcare Act is not sitting well with a number of entities across the health and political spectrum. The GOP health plan is designed to repeal as much of the Affordable Care Act as possible. The CBO estimates repeal of the individual mandate, the elimination of the Medicaid expansion, could cost states and millions of health consumers their coverage. According to the nonpartisan CBO, the American Healthcare Act would lead to 24 million Americans losing health coverage in the coming years, leading to a projected uninsurance rate of 52 million Americans in 8 years, higher than before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Cost for insurance would go up initially, an estimated 20% next year, but those who do buy insurance will receive some tax credits over time. Younger, healthier people would pay much lower premiums. The GOP bill will end up costing older, sicker people up to 5 times as much in premiums. But elimination of the Medicaid expansion is expected to have the biggest impact on the poor and working poor who now receive coverage. An estimated 95% of those who receive coverage under the ACA would not be able to retain it under the GOP plan. Republicans in the Senate have a slim 2-vote majority, and a number of Republican senators are raising concern about the bill, including Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, all Republicans. The American Health Care Act will face an uphill battle in the Senate without full GOP support. Relatively little resistance has been registered for President Trump's pick to head the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Scott Gottlieb is an MD, Wall Street operative, and longtime friend of the pharmaceutical industry, working inside the FDA now. Opponents fear he may be too cozy with the industry and could promote changes that would put drug approval ahead of consumer safety. Although observers note he is far less likely to act recklessly than some others who were under consideration. Saving an hour of daylight, but at what cost? It's becoming increasingly clear that losing an hour of sleep when clocks spring forward to promote daylight savings time has become a growing health concern. Incidents of stroke, a 25% increase in heart attack, and increased car accidents have been charted in the aftermath of clocks being moved ahead 1 hour. Sleep researchers note that even a slight shift in sleep patterns can have negative effects. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest community-based nonprofit organization committed to improving mental health in this country. Mr. Gianfrido was appointed in 2013 to the National Advisory Council at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. He has also served at the Connecticut State Legislature and as mayor of Middletown, Connecticut. He's written extensively on behavioral health issues, including his critically acclaimed book, Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. He's a graduate of Wesleyan University and a good friend of ours. Paul, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for inviting me to be on.
When you look at the stats, you realize no one is immune. It's estimated that 1 in 5 Americans will have some diagnosable mental health issue in any given year, and yet many simply don't get help they need. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about the impact of unmet behavioral health needs in this country and why diagnosis and treatment pose such a challenge.
Well, for the longest time, we've treated mental health concerns and conditions as public safety problems and not as public health problems. As a result, when we deinstitutionalized our population in the 1980s, when we closed our state mental health beds and facilities, we reopened them as county jails. That puts a real damper on people's willingness to seek help and to take out into the open the kinds of symptoms they've got. What Mental Health Month has been about is taking a month where people can talk about mental health openly. People can talk about what it feels like to have a mental illness openly. And we can begin to move from this public safety model to a public health model and get services better integrated into the regular healthcare delivery system.
Well, Paul, now you're at the helm of the nation's oldest organization dedicated to promoting earlier diagnoses and improving access to mental health services. So talk with us about the key goals of Mental Health America and how your efforts like your B4 Stage 4 program are really positioned to help achieve these goals.
Yeah, what Mental Health America stands for is 4 things. Prevention for all, early identification and intervention for those at risk, integrated health, behavioral health, and other services such as education services, housing supports, employment supports for those who need them. So we've made mental health concerns and conditions the only chronic diseases we wait until stage 4 to treat. So a year and a half ago, we launched our Before Stage 4 initiative, which is designed to move people's attention upstream in the process, to have people think about intervening at stage 1 or stage 2, not waiting till a crisis has occurred. And we've put a lot of our resources launching an online screening program to make ubiquitous screening the goal of everyone in America, because we believe that kids should be screened for mental health concerns as frequently as they're screened for vision or hearing. We think adults should be screened as frequently as they're screened for blood pressure, and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force agrees with us. They think everybody over the age of 11 ought to be screened annually for mental health.
Well, Paul, you just announced this ambitious initiative with the Walgreens change, and the goal is to provide behavioral health screening for at least 3 million people through Walgreens' national network of stores in the coming years. How will folks who receive diagnosis get interventions they need in a timely fashion?
Millions of people come to us via our website and through social media, and millions of people every day visit Walgreens' website. So initially, we've put this together to operate in this virtual environment where if people go to mhascreening.org, they're able to screen anonymously using the very same clinical tools that what we're providing for Walgreens is a set of online tools and resources that people will be able to use post-screening to learn more about the conditions they've got. And what Walgreens is going to be able to provide are some more linkages to their Chat with a Pharmacist program, for example. Our local affiliates, we have 100 of them around the country, will be in a position to take referrals as well and get people connected to local providers and other support services in their communities.
I'm interested in this breakthrough system that Walgreens is using and that facilitates interaction with clinicians online and includes a medication adherence tool. Talk about how emerging technologies like this are making a large-scale program possible in a way that would have been very difficult to achieve in the past.
Yeah, in the past, we were pretty much tied to physical locations. They'd pretty much have to go to someone or someplace You know, in recent years, the online environments have changed this dramatically, and there are a lot of services that are moving into digital space. The best ones are Fitbits, which give you instantaneous feedback about certain things that are going on in your body, like your heart rate and the number of steps you're taking and things like that. Young people especially are interested in using these kinds of tools. 3/4 of the people who use our screening tools are under the age of 25. 2/3 of those people tell us they've never been diagnosed with anything. Pretty hard to get somebody to adhere to treatment when they've never received a diagnosis. So what we're trying to get them to do is take a next step with some of these tools and actually be willing to talk further about it, be willing to take their results to a clinician at stage one in the process where recovery comes a lot easier.
We're speaking today with Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest community-based not-for-profit organization committed to improving mental health in this country. Paul, you've written about your own personal experience navigating the mental health system in your book, Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. And you even noted as a young lawmaker, you inadvertently supported laws that made screening treatment options more difficult for families to access. I wonder if you could pull those together and share with us the story about Tim and the navigation that you had to go through with the Connecticut system, and also give us an update on how Tim's doing.
Yeah, Tim right now is 31 years old, and for the last 10 years, he's been mostly homeless on the streets of San Francisco. Recently, he's come back into services a little bit, has had some housing. We actually got a chance to visit him about 6 weeks ago, and he was doing very well and hoping at this point to stay in services. But all too frequently, when he's come back into housing first, he's tended to be evicted from that housing, and then we lose track of him for weeks or months at a time again. Part of the reason he's evicted is because he just doesn't follow the rules because he's got schizophrenia and can't. What I think we made as our biggest mistake in the 1980s was not understanding that while the people who are coming out of our state hospitals were adults, the people who were going into them were kids. Half of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14. And these are childhood diseases, childhood problems, and we never built a system of supports around our children. What happened to Tim is what happens to a lot of kids like that. They get into the school system, and the schools have no idea what to do with them. Even though they're legally required to provide individualized services and programs for those kids. So I think that that's the mistake we made as a matter of public policy in the course of the last 30 years. So we're continuing to see policies in America that are going to continue to put more people like Tim out on the streets. And we at Mental Health America are really trying to put in place policies that will recognize early, that will get services to kids in the schools, in their communities early on, and that will change the trajectories of these kids' lives.
Well, Paul, families often encounter the toughest challenges once kids age out of the system and aren't eligible for some of those supportive programs they may have had. And certainly as the state budgets are floundering, we see families finding it tougher and tougher to find safe homes and dependable programs for their adult children who grapple with complex mental health issues. And in fact, The Atlantic just had a very powerful article describing the nation's jails and prisons as the largest mental health hospitals in the country. I wonder if we could talk a little more about solutions. Where are the solutions for these young adults and older adults now? You know, Tim is an example, and Tim's got the most supportive family in the world trying to help him, but lots of folks don't. So what are the solutions to really help these people?
Well, I think the simplest solution is, in a way, the most obvious one. We've asked the members of Congress to include a provision in federal reform legislation, which remains in the House bill at this point, that would end the incarceration of nonviolent offenders with serious mental illness within 10 years. States could do that as well because there's plenty of money and plenty of resources out there. But we've got to stop putting people in jail, and we've got to stop using the jails as treatment programs for adults. If we did that, we would free up literally millions and millions of dollars that we would be able to put into the building of the community-based mental health systems that we promised to people back in the 1980s. And it's as simple as that, I think. Let's get them out of the jails, and let's move the money from the jails to follow the people back out in the communities. Put clinical support folks, peers, clinicians into the mix as opposed to just judges and lawyers and police officers.
You know, Paul, you've talked about getting behavioral health services to children early on. We've also been very committed to sort of redefining the primary care space and have made available to schools throughout our state the opportunity to have a behavioralist full-time in their school. But also in the primary care space, you know, the embedded behavioralist in primary care. We really need to take advantage of the care delivery system and try to have people reimagine the way delivery might happen. And we note that the Affordable Care Act is out there trying to promote models aimed at better outcomes. What do you see as interesting initiatives in the primary care space that people in the country should be keeping an eye on?
What I think that people need to be doing is, first and foremost, making certain that primary care clinicians are educated to and informed about the need for integration of health and behavioral health services. These responsibilities fall on them anyway, whether they're pediatricians or adult service providers. Similarly, the behavioral health providers need to understand better about how to integrate their work into primary care and into educational settings and others. I really do think we have to break down a lot of the barriers between the schools and the educators who understand that their primary purpose is to educate kids, but don't always understand that some kids aren't available to learn unless you deal with their health issues as well. And I think that involves providing supports into the educational system. But if we then turn around and have a special ed system that says if you're going to provide those supports, you've got to pay for them, most schools are going to continue to be reluctant to do that. So I think we also need to reform some of our special education laws and maybe take a look at allowing mandatory parts of kids' individualized education programs be covered not by the education department, but by their kids' private health insurance if it's otherwise available to provide some of those services and supports. Mm-hmm. I think we just have to reimagine this system and say, this is about health, not about safety. And we have to throw out what we've done, which is in school suspension, expulsion with adults, it's putting them into jails and prisons. And we have to say, okay, purpose is to keep kids in their families, to keep kids in their schools. The purpose is to keep adults with their families, to keep them in their jobs. And whether that's a service that's provided on site, or if in the case of kids, maybe it's provided by a mentor. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of tools. As I say in the book, it's a chain of neglect when we don't do anything. And there are a lot of ways to break a chain. You only have to do it in one place, though. Mm-hmm. And that's what will change things. So, and we just have to get everybody in the country who haven't even envisioned the idea of integrating services yet mm-hmm. in any meaningful way to just start thinking about it.
But Paul, you serve on the advisory council that the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, along with so many other things that you're doing. We had the administrator, Kana Enomoto, on the show recently, and certainly we were talking about the just enormous problem of addiction right now, and particularly opioid addiction. I wonder how your organization is grappling with this mix of both the mental illness issues and also the addiction issues that have just so powerfully swept across the country.
I think we have something of a different take on it as well. We have seen certain drugs become gateways, and thinking particularly of drugs like marijuana, which for a lot of our population have been, for lack of a better way to describe it, effective self-management of symptoms that have landed people as a gateway to jail. We need to rethink a lot of the way we fought our war on drugs here and to make available to people the kinds of pharmaceuticals that they need that will actually mitigate symptoms and not really force them into employing strategies to get pharmaceuticals that may not be quite the ones they need that are creating a lot of the crisis that, frankly, has been around in our country for generations now, but has been confined largely to low-income communities and minority communities. And it's only in recent years that people have begun to notice that actually this is everywhere. I remember, you know, one high school principal telling me when Tim was growing up that, you know, marijuana was in our high school. And I wanted to tell him, you know, when I was in high school, you know, marijuana was in your high school. But we ignored some of this for an awful long time, and I think we're paying the price.
We've been speaking with Paul Gianfrido, president and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest organization dedicated to improving behavioral health services for all people in this country. You can learn more about their work by going to mentalhealthamerica.net or following them on Twitter at mentalhealthAM. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to be on.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
House Republicans released their replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act on March 6th. How does the GOP's American Healthcare Act differ from the ACA? The law keeps several aspects of the ACA, including the requirement that insurance companies offer coverage to anyone, regardless of pre-existing conditions, the essential health benefits requirement that plans must cover 10 health services, including maternity coverage and prescription drugs, and the bill keeps the provision allowing young adults under the age of 26 to remain on their parents' plans. So what is eliminated? Under the GOP plan, there's no mandate to have insurance or pay a tax. Businesses with 50 or more full-time workers also aren't required to offer insurance or pay penalties. However, insurance companies can charge 30% higher premiums for 1 year to those buying their own insurance who didn't have continuous coverage. The law also phases out the Medicaid expansion under the ACA in 2020, at which point no new enrollment under the expansion can occur. The bill doesn't eliminate the Medicaid expansion coverage for those who are enrolled prior to 2020, but if they have a break in coverage for more than 1 month, they won't be able to re-enroll. Many of the taxes under the ACA are also eliminated, as are cost-sharing subsidies that lower out-of-pocket costs. Premium tax credits stay, however, but instead of a sliding scale based on income, as under the ACA, the Republican plan's tax credits are based on age. Insurers can also charge older Americans up to 5 times more than younger people. The ratio is 3-to-1 under the ACA. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Jose Geronimo was studying medicine in his native Peru, he encountered a sobering statistic. While death from cervical cancer had significantly been reduced in the United States, it was still a significant cause of death from women elsewhere in the world. Some 270,000 deaths per year.
There are almost 300,000 women dying of cervical cancer every year without any justification. That is a failure of medicine, just seeing those women dying.
He understood that the greatest challenge was the lack of access to screening. Dr. Geronimo decided to make it his mission to eliminate that disparity. He realized that his first step in his campaign to eliminate cervical cancer deaths was to launch a screening for the human papilloma virus, the leading cause of cervical cancer. He knew that identifying those women with the virus could narrow their search for those who were most likely to have the disease.
There are billions of women in the planet who are too old for this vaccine. They are already sexually active. And those women are at high risk of dying of cervical cancer if we don't do this prevention with affordable screening and affordable treatments.
He also knew a more portable cervical cancer screening and treatment tool needed to be deployed in the field, one that came with its own power source and had the capacity to facilitate removal of cervical lesions in early stage cancer. He launched the CARE HPV program.
Creating this very portable device that is powered by a battery, the device has its own light to illuminate the cervix. You can work with this device. You have the power to provide the treatment.
Jose Geronimo is the senior advisor for women's cancer with the Reproductive Health Program at PATH, a nonprofit organization dedicated to launching innovations to improve global health, where he leads the validation and demonstration of new molecular technologies for cervical cancer screening. Since he launched his CARE HPV program, more than 100,000 diagnostic kits and treatment units have been deployed across several countries, providing early-stage treatment and diagnosis for women who previously had no access.
Those women who are at risk of dying of cervical cancer in the next year, we need to do something now.
A cervical cancer reduction campaign fostered by an aggressive screening treatment program using low-resource tools that are highly effective in the field, yielding better outcomes for tens of thousands of women, helping them avoid an early death. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.